The Tom Woods Show, episode 597.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, don't miss out on the event of the year. Bob Murphy and I are hosting a cruise. That's right, it's the Contra Cruise, October 9th to 16th, 2016, aboard Royal Caribbean. Check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the show. I really talked up this episode the other day, but as you're going to hear for yourselves, I was not exaggerating. I mean, you're going to have to pause and catch your breath in the middle of this episode, I'm telling you. Because my guest today is Dale Brown. Commander Dale Brown is the founder of the Detroit Threat Management Center. And all I'll say right now is that he founded that at a time when the Detroit police either could not or would not deal with the problem of violent crime. And so Dale Brown created a private, voluntary alternative that sought to do three things. First, try to stop all this violent crime. Second, try to prevent crime from occurring in the first place. And third, try to avoid violence, try to diffuse situations without violence. It is an incredible story, and I know you're going to enjoy it. Dale Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. It's great to be here.
I am very interested in the Detroit Threat Management System. Give me the basic two-minute pitch. Give me the overview of what you do and what's valuable about it.
Well, what we do at Detroit Threat Management Center, first and foremost, is we are a school. We're an educational resource. We teach people how to manage threats for their families, for themselves, for their communities, and their corporations, and how to do it nonviolently. So it's how to create safety in general, in the educational system. Then I took it a step further, and out of necessity, because people were being home invaded and murdered on the east side of Detroit, where I lived, and the reluctance of law enforcement to be preventive as opposed to prosecutorial, I had to create a long-term sustainable solution to community safety. So at first, I just volunteered to protect families by giving the legal rights as the security for the buildings that they lived in to protect them. I was able to legally, meaning not be stopped by the legal system, from protecting other American citizens right here in America from violent aggression. And without understanding the law, they would have stopped me willingly and aggressively. That being said, I created a sustainable system. I trained people as bodyguards to create excellence in managing human threats through nonviolent approaches. And as a result, it turns out that wealthy people get wealthier when there's less death, carnage, lawsuits, injuries, and incarcerations on their property. This means that they like my peaceful approach because it means more prosperity for them, but my focal point was community family safety, not allowing violent criminals to attack families. So it's a win for everyone, and it's sustainable because it's profitable. So that's the main thing that I want to get across, and that's why I'm glad to be here on your show, is because people need to know that there is prosperity with preventive protection as a model for managing human threat.
Now, how long ago was this that you got started?
I started in 1994, I started teaching. In 1995, I started the security side of what we do and out of necessity. So at first, I was teaching in parks here in Detroit. And I'm originally from Ann Arbor, Michigan, home of the University of Michigan, where law enforcement views their position as one to protect the public community from violence, especially the students, which pays their salaries, which was excessively high and remains so. However, when I came to Detroit, I found out that the law enforcement community was bent on one thing, and that is prosecution. You know, no matter how much I pleaded with them to protect the population, they just weren't interested as a group. African-American, as well as Caucasian officers, it was across the board. The preoccupation was in predatory policing with the idea that we need to incarcerate people by any means necessary, setting up police stings, selling drugs, anything we can do to create the conditions for crime, and then hold the people accountable to go to prison for those crimes that were preventable. And that's what I do. I prevent violent criminal activities. My staff is focused on public safety through nonviolence by creating conditions where violence cannot occur because predators cannot prey upon the families and the businesses, and it's profitable for everyone and positive.
All right, that's what I want to talk about. You can't, of course, arrest people the way the police can. So some people might be skeptical and say, then what can you do? Without the power to arrest, there isn't any contribution you can make, but obviously you are making a contribution. So give me some specifics. Exactly how are you able to provide security without having the police monopoly on force that they have?
Excellent point. You see, people are very confused. What does arrest get you? How does arrest help you? How does arrest help your community? Go and look at the data and look and see if arrest helped you in some way. It doesn't help. The only thing that helps you is everything that happens before an arrest, which means before laws are broken. See, we've been programmed as a society to believe that law enforcement has something to do with the structure of societal structure in terms of safety, which is not related at all. An example is there are 2,000 law enforcement officers here in Detroit now. They call it woefully understaffed. There were set to 7,000 officers in the 70s and 60s. Well, there were also riots, and there was also lots more violence against, perpetrated against civilians. There were a lot of more officers being killed, and as a result, it was all in all worse for property values, more incarceration, so more cops did not add more profitable outcomes, more of a prosperous community, more of a safe community. There was no correlation between adding arrest ability and the enforcement of laws, which is a after-the-fact event. There's no correlation between that and a good quality of life. So the question is, and I'm so glad you asked this, arrest powers have nothing to do with safety. You see, the only way you can arrest someone is if, in fact, a crime has already been committed, a rape, a robbery, or killing. We don't get involved in drugs and other issues that are nonviolent. We focus on just violence. And violence, any citizen can stop a violent act. Any citizen can take someone into custody if they rape someone or rob someone or attempted to kill someone. You can shoot and kill someone anytime you get ready to, anytime you want to intervene in someone else murdering another person. So that has nothing to do with arresting. And that's what we focus on, is violence, not on, did you have a seatbelt on? Are you texting? Are you arguing outside loud? We don't want to arrest people anyway. And I teach people that this whole concept that we're under force, violence, aggression, and arrest is completely counterintuitive, counterproductive, and completely unnecessary. And that's what my model is demonstrating over 20 years here in the city of Detroit, downtown, in the neighborhood, not in Oshkosh, Bagosh, Michigan. This is the real city, and it really works. And if you look at crimemapping.com, you will see an extremely low amount of crime anywhere that we work. And this is the most important part. Altruism and mission-motivated action is the purpose of the organization, and it's the foundation. If I go forward in a safety situation with the idea that I'm just here to prosper and be profitable, then what happens is the moment I'm in true danger, I have to back down. I have to leave because there's no prosperity in death, and death is a possibility when you are interacting with people, whether you're in Colorado at a movie theater or at a college campus where most of our mass shootings are taking place, which I think is interesting since people are very worried about trailer parks and inner city ghettos. You never have mass shootings there. But if you're going to intervene, you can't think about prosperity because you're about to die. So what happens is you have to think about the love of humanity. And that's very important to get across to your audience, is that if we're going to protect our families, our communities, and our corporations, we can only do that with love, not with law enforcement. The enforcement of laws takes place after they've been broken, which means your family's been raped, robbed, or killed. You've already had a shooting at your business, and you are now financially in a negative situation. And, of course, you're very unhappy with rape, robbery, and killing that happens to your family or in your community.
So what is it that you're able to do then before the fact to stop these things from happening? Is it a lot of patrolling?
Oh, it's what we call a scanning, deter, detect, defend. So the first thing we do is basically think about everything you think about in terms of law enforcement, and we do the exact opposite. So a police officer thinks you're a threat. So what they do is pull you over. If we think you're a threat, what we do is pull up to you and talk to you. If a police officer thinks you're a threat, what they do is stay back away from you and pull out their gun. What we do is get so close, you can't pull out your gun. A police officer believes you're a threat, so they begin to talk to you in an autocratic, aggressive fashion. What we do is build a psychological bridge to explain to you that there's no need, there's no option for violence, there's no opportunity, and there's nothing to gain. So you must leave now, and I'm letting you leave. My staff is letting you leave. You can simply go. Now, this works in any situation where the human being is attempting to achieve something. Now, when it's psychological, meaning the person is not thinking well, they're on drugs or they're insane, then our training works very well because we're able to read their body language ahead of time and know that they're about to draw the weapon anyway, and we're able to take them into custody and take them down without injuring them and without letting them pull out their gun. Now, again, we're in Detroit, so this is not theory. This is what we do. This is why none of my staff members are dead. Six of us have been shot as we're learning over these years that my ultra-violent viewpoint was wrong. I was a martial artist all my life, a firearms instructor. I have lots of guns, and I love guns. I'm a gun enthusiast. But that has nothing to do with public safety. An example, the Secret Service has guns, and they never use them. The police have guns, and every dead police officer had a gun at the time of their death. So gun was not the answer in those situations. What would be the answer was in a superior thought process by being able to perceive situations before they happen, be in position to dominate in situations which were dedicated, and create a psychological bridge for someone to pass you to go down into a peaceful outcome. And this is completely unique and a new paradigm shift in public safety, and it works, and I can prove it. So it's no longer theory. It's not speculation. It's not anecdotal. The law enforcement community is responding extremely well to our training system and the outcomes that we're having because they're getting full credit for it if you look at their crime data. So there's no special police crime data point that says, does the public safety private sector help your staff? That is not an option to data to their data. So all they know is I have less 911 calls in this area. I have less injured and killed in this area. I have less violence in this area. Therefore, I'm good. And that's law enforcement getting credit for our work. And that's fine. I don't care. What I care about is public safety, families not living in fear and in terror right here in America.
Well, that brings up a question I was going to ask you anyway. What is your relationship with the police, and has it changed over time?
It definitely changed. It was terrible at first. Law enforcement was very obstruction-oriented. Their objective was to, and as I realized, I grew up in the suburbs. I'm African-American. The people that I grew up with were primarily Caucasian. And when I came to Detroit and I was surrounded by African-American neighbors, I was really astounded at their viewpoint towards law enforcement. I was really shocked. I couldn't believe that they had no trust for them because I'd always seen police officers as professional and helpful. So I was very shocked to find out that I was giving them bad advice by telling them to go to the police and report what's going on and go to the police station and you got to work with the police. I didn't know that law enforcement at that time was very fixated on one thing, and that was imprisoning every single African-American they could under all conditions, real or false. And I really didn't believe them until I experienced it. I would go into police departments, the police precincts here, and they just could not believe that, that they're being asked to help people. And they were offended and became aggressive towards the victims of crime that I would bring in the police department. They were aggressive towards, they were semi-aggressive towards me, but because of my speech pattern, because of where I grew up, I call it the Brian Gumbel. They were intimidated by me. I think they thought I was a Fed. And so law enforcement officers did not believe I was poor. I was very poor. When I started, I had no money. I was an airborne paratrooper, but I did not have any money. And I got in the military, and I was a private investigator when I got in the military. And I they really did not believe that I was actually poor, and I was volunteering to help people, and I was teaching self-defense in the parks, and I was, I had no money. But now, obviously we're extremely wealthy. We have boats and Hummers and all kinds of extremely exotic vehicles and equipment, but that came from one thing and one thing only, sweat equity and prosperity driven by the prevention of violence in a non-violent way. I would not have boats. I would not have expensive equipment and motorcycles, a tactical training facility that is the only, one of the only full-time tactical training facilities open, 7 days a week. And I have that because I created prosperous outcomes over and over again without lawsuits, without injuries, without death, no killing of unarmed people of any descent. And we have been attacked. We have been you know, in the most ultra violent situations. And I learned through these extreme violent conditions, better ways of creating outcomes. And all I can tell you is, it was also because I had to. I'm accountable. I have no qualified immunity. That means if I put my hands on someone, it has to be legal. There has to be a way for me to explain this as a civilian. And as a result, we've had no court dates in 20 years, no lawsuits in 20 years.
Wow. Wow.
Now, that is hard to do. If you understand this industry, that is like magic.
Yeah.
I'm like the David Copperfield of public safety.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because people lie. There's mental patients out here. There's just psych patients. There's actual criminals that lie on you. We use video. We use data. We use every kind of advanced piece of equipment to create these outcomes. So we don't use any trust. We don't use any words. We use everything we can prove. So we use video evidence for everything when we're talking about our perspective. And that's why we don't have those negative outcomes. Not because I have a secret island I get the best people from. It's because I have a training system that does not include aggression at all on non-aggressive people. And in when dealing with aggressive people, it's still a way to dominate them without injuring them. And so if you scale this up, this is something that can be used worldwide across our country and in other countries. And that's what I designed it for. How can I take this forward and it be something you can use everywhere in our country under all jurisdictions and in other countries as well without having negative outcomes?
It's like you're reading the questions off my paper here, because I had also jotted down, has there been any interest in trying to duplicate what you're doing in other cities?
Yes, there's interest in duplication. We're franchising, and we're not just franchising, but we're looking at ways of expanding both the commercial side of what we do, private, you know, commercial side. We have no, we're an NGO, so I don't get any funding from the government, nor do I want any, nor do I need any. We are not a nonprofit. We are a for-profit corporation that is altruistic. So we help people that do not have money for free. And that's a volunteer effort by myself and my bodyguards. And that's why I make sure I don't have mercenaries. Mercenaries, by definition, are cowards. These are people that carry guns and use force for violence purposes for money. There is nothing positive about that. And any mercenary that's faced with a situation that's ultimately something that's not self-preservation oriented realizes at that moment, not before, but at that moment, that it's going to be really hard to spend money when you're dead. So at the moment, so if what you're doing is for money, obviously you're not going to be doing it when you know you're not going to get any. And so these guys talk tough with guns and mercenary mindsets, but as soon as death is on the table, they're going to run. And so I have to make sure I weed those kinds of people out. And I find people that are genuinely driven by the love of humanity, that realize there are women, children, elderly, and families out here, whole families that need help with protection, that is prevention of their death. And that is what they want, and no one's providing that. There is no law enforcement community, no law enforcement entity that prevents your death. There's no prevention unit. Like, you can't call the police and say, listen, next Thursday at 3 p.m., someone's coming to kill me, an employee, an ex-wife, ex-girlfriend, ex-husband. They're coming to kill me. I'd like you to be here to die for me or with me, or, you know, possibly kill him if you can when he comes to kill me. That does not happen. That's not real.
Right.
Only on TV. In real life, they're going to tell you, call us if they show up with their gun to kill you. But of course, you're dead by the time they get there.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be there half an hour later. Right.
In Detroit, it's 2 hours later, and that's for a good reason. You can't retire if you're dead. Okay? So when you're asking police officers, and I tell this people all the time, police officers sign up for a job. They put in an application, and they went to work. Okay? Just like you, anyone else who went to work. Someone went to college. They didn't sign up to go die in your backyard because you decided to date someone or have a husband or wife that's not right, or, you know, live next to, you know, people that are doing something illegal, or, you know, that's not what they signed up for. They don't want a new mate in their home for their spouse. They don't want a new dad or mom for their children. So when you're asking them to rush over to your problem, you're asking a lot of a person. What I do is I look for those people day one when I agree to teach them. I'm not looking for employees with the mindset of I just want to work for money. And when we have those kinds of people, we make sure we don't put them in positions to be trusted as bodyguards. So we have basic security positions for them in the employment side of what we do, which is related to a security guard function. And we actually partner with a security guard company for that to take place. And those individuals help you know, generate income for us to function as well. But understand that they are not, those are not bodyguards. Those are just our security guard section. And we have a way of testing and validating them for actual protective service that is related to protecting people's lives.
Well, just so we can understand your business model a little better, how exactly do you earn revenue?
We provide, through a security guard firm, we provide security guard services to communities and corporations.
Okay.
So an example is when I first started, I was just in neighborhoods in the east side of Detroit, a place the police and citizens called Crack Alley. Basically, it was 10 apartment buildings, 400 dwellings, maybe 100 aggressors. So one quarter of the population was, you know, violence-oriented gang members. The rest were just families and senior citizens. Hundreds of people needed help. And I couldn't get the police to help them, so I got volunteers. I talked to the business owners, and I said, listen, give me a free apartment in your building, and I'll train a person to protect your building, and we'll get rid of these home invasions and these murders. And this was every month. Every day there was a home invasion, and every month, this is one square block, okay? And every month, there were murders. And so what happened was, from the day I started, there was only one more home invasion. I caught them. And there were no more murders from the day I started. So the building owner suddenly went into the black for the first time in 20 years because no one moved from the buildings and everyone paid their rent.
Ah.
As a result of people paying their rent because there's no murders, rapes, and killings, all of a sudden the corner store, the liquor store, the laundromat, all those places started to flourish because they had more customers.
This is so smart. This is so smart. Now, what's been your biggest challenge?
Well, the challenges have evolved as we evolve. So at first it was police officers interfering in protecting the family, literally interfering. So they'd see us with our rifles outside of buildings where I started. We were very gun intensive. So not only would I have guns, I would have the best guns, like anything that was 30 caliber or higher, 7.62, and with lots of rounds. This was I thought was the best approach because I was a soldier. I was a martial artist all my life. So for me, it was, you know, I'm going to use superior violence of action to change human behavior. And to a certain degree, it works. What I found out would work better was cameras. Believe it or not, violent criminals hate video cameras because it takes away anonymity and proves that they're the ones doing something. And they know that. That actually worked way better than a 30-round magazine or a 50-round magazine or drum. And so I slowly changed out over many years from guns to cameras. They just were a lot more effective. A broke camera was more effective at getting rid of drug-dealing gangs than actual guns.
Huh.
Imagine that. In my mindset, that wasn't even a possibility. So instead of me using my force of violence and superior violence concept, I imagine if I went to a group of drug dealers, you know, it's about 15 of them sunbathing outside of a farm building full of families who are terrified. And I said, gentlemen, listen, so I'll let you know the police, they're taking our footage and they are analyzing it. They're looking for criminals who are wanted. And I just want to let you guys know, you know, I'm not saying you guys are drug dealers or anything like that. I'm just letting you know they're taking our footage and they're, you know, looking for people with warrants and they're, you know, taking it from us. So the thug looks at me and says, oh, this is their gang leader. He's like, man, thank you. Good looking out. And so they go in the building, right, and hide from our cameras, and they're not our enemy because they believe I'm giving them information that helps them. Want the truth? The police couldn't care less about our footage. And by the way, I was so poor at the time, the cameras that I had were broken. We were just pointing broken cameras from top of the
building. Oh, my gosh.
We had no money. So I had some broken video cameras. I had some volunteers from a high school that scared the drug dealers away. Now, what does that mean? That means when a nurse came home with her child, that means when elderly people got off the bus, these were poor people primarily, that meant that they didn't feel terror. That meant they weren't going to get spit on by thugs who were upset because the mother wouldn't give out their phone number. That meant no tyranny for the children who came to these low-income homes and were paying a very, very high wage amount of money for their apartments and getting nothing in return from the building owners who were not interested in public safety, would not give them better lighting, better doors, better locks, which I did suggest. Another example is I put a piece of paper on the walls entering the buildings. So imagine inner city, you know, buildings that you have gangs in them in the hallways and drug gangs running rampant. And I put these signs up and I laminated them to the door. And I know people said that, you know, basically gang members can't read. Apparently they read very well. I typed this document up, put it on the wall, made it look official. And it said, notice to all police, you must call this number because there are undercover armed security posing as drug dealers in these buildings. And I put my cell phone up there. The truth is, police aren't going to leave anything on the wall, and they're definitely not going to call us for any reason, so they didn't. But the drug dealers stopped trusting each other. They were terrified of each other. They thought each one of them was actually one of us. And the truth is, I had no undercovers. I had no one with guns running around undercover. That was just a lie. That lie caused them to not get along, to not want to be in the hallways, to not talk to each other, which once again meant a higher quality of life, safer for the families that live in the buildings, which are hundreds of families with little children, older people, senior citizens living in terror, now have a quieter life because there's less drug dealers and thugs. These are drug thugs. These aren't like drug dealers that are dealing drugs to another adult. These are actual guys who are dealing drugs just so they can get more bullets, more guns, and more ability to hurt people. And so there's a difference. There are real drug dealers. These were not them. These were like thug dealers and gangs of them. But we made them psychologically not want to be there. We created an aversion, and they took hold of it and stopped wanting to be around there. Then the final one I'm going to tell you, I have a video that shows us pull up broad daylight. I get out of a car. It's just getting dusk, and there's eight drug dealers on a corner, just like in the movies. And one big, really big guy with a big afro, 6'8", looks like a lineman from a football team. And the other guy has long hair, looks like a pimp. They step forward from the group of eight drug dealers. Two of them step forward. When I said to them, you got to clear the area on a PA system. And I'm in an unmarked van and I'm in uniform. But I said, you know, there's a spotlight, but it's just getting dusk. And this is on a major street in Detroit, very close to where our mayor lives. And these two drug dealers get off the curb and they yell, we're not moving, we're not leaving. And so I approach them, and you can see it on video. And as we approach, the one guy kind of reaches forward towards me. So you hear me, you can see me on film, take a baton, smash it across his shin, and you hear like a breaking noise, cracking noise. He stutters, lifts me off the ground. I choke him down, and I choke him into this van, and I take him away, as well as another staff member takes the other guy away. So these two men are seen being choked away, screaming, gurgling, and they're never seen again. The other drug dealers that are on the corner never come back to that corner ever again. That corner had had drug dealers up until 1994, 1995, since the 60s. Okay? So this is the first time it's been clear. If you go there today, and I have not been there active in over 15 years, there's still no drug dealers there right now. 20 years later, there's no drug dealers in this corner. And what's interesting is the building owners, some of which flew in from Florida, very wealthy people, came in to terminate me because they heard that I had choked these drug dealers out and disappeared them. There was actually an investigation launched, I learned later. They called us the body snatchers because we snatched these guys off the street and no one ever saw them again. And I showed them the video, and they were mortified. These very wealthy men were mortified, not terrified for some reason. I don't know why they weren't terrified. If they thought I abducted drug dealers, the first thing I would think if I were them was, I don't want to get abducted too.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with this guy.
Right, but I want to be real happy so I get out of here and get my lawyer and fire this guy, right? But no, they fired me immediately. They were like, you know what? You're disappearing drug dealers. We're going to terminate you right now. And I said, why are you going to terminate me? He goes, because you can't do that. I said, yeah, I can. Everything I did was legal. And they were like, how is it possible for you to legally abduct people on the city streets and drag them away? I said, I didn't abduct anyone. I didn't hit anyone. And I didn't take anyone away against their will. They were like, what do you mean? The two men that we struck, the two men that I choked, the two men that we dragged away, these men essentially are my students, a part of my academy. They were acting like drug dealers. And for 4 hours prior to this, we were driving up to them, giving them money, no drugs, just giving them money. So the other drug dealers really thought they were real drug dealers. So it looked real to the actual drug dealers that these two guys, they were smart enough, they realized the reason why one of the guys is 6'8 with a big afro and looks like a football player because he is a Wayne State University football player.
Oh, wow.
They joined our organization. The other guy is actually a post office worker, and he's posing as this drug dealer. And we beat them with rubber sticks. There's no actual, metal or anything. They weren't hurt. And the next day they got haircuts because we have a very strict dress code. The next day they were in uniform with haircuts, so nobody recognized them.
That is unbelievable.
And the drug dealer stayed away. The kid, there was no violence. There was no court case. And we cleaned up the area using psychology, not physicality. That's the moral of the story. Nonviolence works. You just have to outthink the violent criminal, and it changes their behavior, and we can create a nonviolent outcome just by having strategies to inspire people, not intimidate them, inspire them to think differently.
Tell us your website, because I know after listening to this conversation, my listeners are going to want to learn more.
Our website is threatmanagementcenter.com, threatmanagementcenter.com. And what we specialize in is nonviolence. The prosecutors and domestic violence shelters, domestic violence units, domestic violence courts for serious domestic violence situations have used us actively for the past 15 years, keeping people alive. We've been doing it for 20 years, but the actual organization spun out about us about 15 years ago. And the bodyguards in my organization, in order for me to train them, have to agree to volunteer to protect people the same way they would their own sister, their own mother, their own daughter. These are primarily domestic violence victims. Quite a few are elderly, and in some cases, whole families are being aggressed on. That means there's a man at the house, there's a wife, and there's children, and they need protection. There is no protection in any city. And we work out in the country with country people as well as inner city people. We have a multicultural staff. We have Christians, Muslims. We have African-Americans. We have Caucasian people. We have every kind of person. We have a lot of people from other countries all working together for one thing, and that's to create a peaceful place for people to live nonviolently. And, again, we work in all communities. So we've helped families in Canada and these are volunteer. Now, the wealth comes from our wealthy clients, but the people that are in extreme danger are generally the poor people that can't afford our services. And, these are just serious situations where people are being shot, abducted, attempted murder. One lady we're actually working with, and this is the first time, this is only the second time this has happened. Law enforcement has directly, law enforcement community directly coordinating with us to provide protection for an actual crime victim. Our objective is to keep this lady alive. She was just shot 3 times in her driveway because she was going to testify against the man who robbed her at an ATM machine. Well, what happens normally is these women, these old people that are shot, what they do is get scared and leave the community, and they don't testify. This family is leaving the community. They have money. They have enough money. They can move wherever they want. They just like living in Detroit up until now. So they're moving. But they are also still going to agree to testify when she gets out of the hospital, and we're going to protect them to and from their home as they move their things so they don't get killed, just moving their items. Because if this woman is killed, these 3 men do not go to prison. Okay, that's how our legal system works. So instead of complaining about police and complaining about not protection and complaining about, police brutality, what we do is create conditions by training police officers, specifically on tactics, which you'll see on our website. We train police officers how to overcome fear by having tactics and skills that allow them to dominate people without injuring them, without killing them in a very easy way. We teach a system based in biomechanics, not based in physicality. So, and again, it's used in real life. So this is not a theoretical system. Hundreds of thousands of times here in the Detroit area for 20 years, we have used these techniques on actual violent aggressors, not on people that don't want to get a ticket, not on people that are drunk having a bad day, but gangsters, thugs, criminals, violent men who come to kill people, okay? Our techniques work and they're battle-proven in America under extreme conditions of violence where there are laws. Let me be clear, at the end of situations, the police are coming. So you must understand psychology in order to understand human behavior. You must next understand the law And then you must next understand physical methods of defending yourself. And typically in martial arts training and in firearm schools, there's very little discussion of law, but law is the most important thing. And I don't mean laws in what's written, because as you know, not just law enforcement, the people just don't care about law until it's later, right? Post. What's important is how the law is going to be used against you, and how you can use the law by understanding how to articulate situations, how to understand how it's going to be articulated against you before a legal situation happens. I've been teaching for over 20 years and physically protecting people in force and force violence for over 20 years. That knowledge has allowed me to develop this system. It's not theoretical. And so I say that because I get a lot of feedback from people who think differently. And that's because they haven't been in situations covered in blood and having to explain themselves to law enforcement. They are going to come to that situation. The worst thing you can do is leave the situation. You need to call police, you need to wait for them, and you need to tell them what's going on before someone else reinvents your situation, rearticulates it, and now you're in court. You'd rather get beat up, you'd rather get wounded and go home than go to prison for the rest of your life because you thought you were doing the right thing and it was rearticulated or interpreted differently than it happened, and now you got to go to prison. So what we do is make sure civilians, especially business owners and people that are just regular families, make sure they understand the law and how it's interpreted, and then give them more tools. We give them an actual psychological understanding so they can create, not just hope for, but create a nonviolent outcome with their neighbor, with their employees, with their problematic family member, with a family member that has a mental problem or a drug that's out of control. How do you handle them without killing them? Well, there's a way to do that, and we do it in real life, and we have done it, you know, countless times. And these deaths are avoidable that you're hearing about out here with weapons. It's very avoidable. And so that's what I want to get across to your audience. There are solutions. We need to stop complaining, pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps of knowledge and skill, and just adopt and adapt a different way of thinking in order to have a different outcome. It's a paradigm shift in public safety. Threat management is a new way of creating a nonviolent societal structure by using psychology as opposed to physicality to solve issues.
The website is threatmanagementcenter.com. Our guest has been Dale Brown. I can't thank you enough. I think this has been one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had on the show. What you're doing is absolutely unique, and it's a story that needs to be heard. And frankly, if you ask me, somebody ought to make a movie about what you've been doing. But best of luck, and thanks so much again.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
All right. We'll have the URL over at tomwoods.com/597, the show notes page for today. A quick note about something one of your fellow listeners is up to. I've got two websites to tell you about, and they're both created by a Tom Woods Show listener. One of them is borderlandcandles.com, and the other one is sozocandles.com, and they both are sites where you can get beautiful, naturally fragrant candles. These are candles that are produced using soy wax instead of paraffin, so they burn longer and they don't get all that black soot all over the place. So it's very much worth checking out, especially if you would like to support a fellow Tom Woods Show listener. So borderlandcandles.com and sozocandles.com. If you would like to get a shout out for your not yet created website or blog, because it has to be something you haven't yet done, because you got to sign up through my affiliate link for your hosting service before I can give you this free publicity. But check out my deal at tomwoods.com/publicity. And if you get your hosting through there and you get your site up and running, when you're ready, you just drop me a line and I'll give you some free publicity on my show notes page and in the episode here. Plus, there's a free 5-minute video tutorial showing you how to get up and running. That's how easy it is. 5 minutes and you'll have a blog. Then, plus, I'm giving away 24 free video tutorials to help you become a master blogger. I'm giving this away all for free. All you got to do is check out the deal at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, the weekend is coming up, and maybe, just maybe, there just might be another bonus episode of the Tom Woods Show waiting for you this weekend. So as the weekend goes on, you may start to lose heart. You may say, Woods forgot about us. He said something about a bonus episode, and then he just left us hanging out to dry here. Not so. You just wait. That bonus episode will be on its way. Enjoy your weekend, and thanks so much for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.